Hello and welcome to M&I ECB Speed Podcast. I am Santi Pignol in Rome, and the topic of today is the natural interest rate, also known as RSTAR. Focusing in the Eurozone, has it moved after the pandemic? Why is it so difficult to measure it? To talk about it, we could have not had better guests, as today are with us three senior economists from the European Central Bank. Klaus Brand, who is also the head of strategy issues section at the DG Monetary Policy, Noemi Lizak and Falk Mazelis. The three are the contributors of the article about the natural interest rate that the ECB published in early February. Klaus, Falk and Noemi, it's a pleasure to have you here and welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
So, to start with the conversation, what are the main conclusions from this article that was recently published, would you say?
Yeah, so the box in the bulletin that we published pretty much validates evidence that estimates of the natural rate of interest or equilibrium interest rates have fallen in the wake of the global financial crisis and have remained low, even though we record a small uptick recently in the post-pandemic environment, also owing to the surge of inflation that we have witnessed in the euro area, our estimates remain low.
Okay, one of the conclusions in the article is that the big difference on the calculation also depends a lot on the model. So my question would be, what are the key differences in the models that throw up the different estimates for RSTAR?
So we consider a range of models because we understand every model to have certain benefits and also disadvantages compared to others. And we don't necessarily think that there's one best model, so that's why we have the suite of models. And we group them according to the underlying frameworks and essentially also the inflation stabilizing properties. So we have four different groups. The first one is essentially the DSGE measure, which is a microfounder type of model, and it records an R star that closes the output gap period by period, which then also in the absence of nominal frictions would close the inflation gap period by period. So here we understand inflation stabilizing properties quite well. However, this also then leads to quite pronounced interest rate cycles, as you can see in the chart. Then the next group are semi-structural models. And these models generally feature similar elements to DSG models, but they're also more data-driven at times. And here, targeting RSTAR means that we're essentially closing the inflation gap over a more medium-term horizon. Then we have a group of term structure-based models, which use market data, yield curves, and they remove the risk premium that are otherwise associated with them. And because we're using market data, often these measures are considered to be more of a market-based view of where RSTAR is. So that's one of the advantages of them. However, here the inflation stabilizing properties are typically less well understood because it's not exactly clear at which horizon, if at all, inflation would be stabilized. And then finally, we have survey-based measures. Here we simply report the central tendencies of panelists of those surveys. And so we know exactly what is going on, which panelists gave a certain answer. Honestly, we don't know what the infrastructure is behind every panelist's assessment, but we know that they are also based on certain models, but also include expert judgment. And then within each modeling class, there are of course also different differences in these different models. You know, for example, what type of features models have, whether they're linear or non-linear, and whether they take into account different type of instruments, how they treat the extreme volatility that we saw during COVID, and so forth and so on.
Okay, thank you very much. A question on this that maybe you can ask me, is there any particular model that has been especially affected by the changes that we have seen in the economy after the pandemic?
So generally speaking, a lot of the models that were linear in nature were initially challenged by the large volatility that we saw due to the government shutdowns and then the recovery that happened afterwards, because these models were not necessarily built for this. And you can actually see that with linear models, not just at the ECB or in central banks more broadly, but also in academia, and this was something that the literature had to grapple with and is actually still researching. So here we actually saw an opportunity to revise the machinery that we have at the ECB, but also in other places, to then eventually and finally come out with this new update that you see in the box.
Okay, and to the next question.
Say models that really rely on extracting R star measures based on economic fluctuations, they will translate these economic fluctuations that we saw during the pandemic pretty much directly into fluctuations of R star. While at the same time, we know, for example, survey expectations haven't moved that much in these turbulent times as far as expectations of interest rates in the long run are concerned. Neither have financial market expectations of the short-term rate in the long run gyrated so much. So on that side, when you look at financial market-based measures or survey-based measures, these measures were less susceptible to be affected by the strong macro volatility that we have witnessed in this period.
Okay, perfect. Thank you much. To the next question, it's like, on the article, one of the conclusions is that R-star has moved very little, but my question is, how seriously can the unchanged estimate be when the variables are about 125 basis points apart?
So I think it's a good question. The 125 basis points refer to the upper bound and the lower bound of the range of estimates that we have for R star. And it's true that there is a lot of uncertainty surrounding these R star measures, both due to statistical uncertainty on the estimation of its specific measures, but also due to model uncertainty. And our aim is to take this into account by updating a range of measures rather than just one specific individual estimate. And because of that, what we obtain is a relatively wide range rather than just one specific number. But we still think that we can learn something from this range of measures, especially looking at the broader trends. So what we can say from this estimated measure of R star is that basically, as Cloud said initially, they were around zero before the pandemic, then they decreased to negative values during the pandemic, and then moved back to a narrower range around zero in the post-pandemic period. So this remains true despite the width of estimates, the width of the range of estimates that we have. And it is also true when we look at the median estimate. The median that we have now is relatively similar to the median we had estimated before the pandemic. So even though we cannot pinpoint precise numbers, we can still have informative trends that can be useful.
Okay, thank you very much. And from a policy maker point of view, how do policymakers adapt and use the conceptual tool that is only known in hindsight?
Yeah, I mean, of course, say any of these measures are all backward looking. And even in hindsight, if we look at historical estimates, like in the 70s or 80s for this measure, these across different models, they can vary a lot. So it's a very uncertain variable to be used by policymakers. It's because of these modeling uncertainties, but also because of measurement challenges, that policymakers are generally not prominently considering R-star estimates regularly in policy deliberations from one meeting to the next. We have learned that policymakers focus a lot on trends in these estimates, and this is also why in this box we rather discuss the trends that we observe. They focus on trends because they find them informative of the level towards which interest rates would eventually gravitate as economic shocks wash out of the system and as policymakers move away from a tight or an accommodative, depending on which side you are on, stance of policy towards neutral.
Okay, and all these variables that we have been discussing are the same for the real natural rate and the nominal neutral rate?
So it's important to recall that what matters is really the real neutral rate when you think about understanding the decisions in terms of household spending or firm spending. So given that, what really is important to understand the underlying mechanisms of the economy is the real neutral rate. Because of this, most models will tend to rather first estimate the real neutral rate, and then if we want to compare measures or to compare this estimate with the observed rates, it is useful to be able to translate those measures into nominal terms. So this can be done by just adding the expected inflation to the real rate measures. Then, of course, some models focus on nominal estimates, and then to translate them into real estimates, we do the reverse operation. We subtract the inflation expectations from the nominal rates to get the real rates. And that allows us to then have a set of estimates that are based on similar terms and that are comparable, and also comparable to observed real rates.
Thank you very much, Noemi. And for ending this podcast, I would like you to, if you could give an important idea of the natural interest rate in the euro area that do you think our readers should take into account after your article, that would be important for us.
Yeah, I think what the article didn't discuss in great detail, but mentioned only in one paragraph, is that notwithstanding all the many differences in estimates produced for global interest rate levels or for the euro area, there are lots of qualitative commonalities in terms of what drives these developments. And that's important. The drivers behind R-star point to very important economic challenges that policymakers need to pay a lot of attention to. And these factors are also all interrelated with each other. And that's across models. If you look at the drivers using models, there's still, notwithstanding the differences, lots of commonalities. And in that respect, we would always note that three common factors stand out that help us explain what's been going on, say, over the last one half of a century. And that's essentially risk premium, productivity growth, and demographic developments. And these point to very important economic challenges. So in terms of the risk premium, also often is often referred to as the safe asset scarcity. What's behind this is basically the legacy of the global financial crisis, which destroyed risk appetite and brought along a lot of risk aversion on the part of investors and a swathe of regulation, a shift to collateralization in financial markets and in the financial system. And this has created lasting changes in the economic and the financial system, contributing to a decline in yields on safe assets. What also contributed to a decline in yields on safe assets are global imbalances, in particular reserve accumulation by emerging market economies, right? So globalization, financial globalization, is also behind these developments. Then another aspect that is often mentioned is productivity. growth, which has declined a lot, say, since the beginning of the 1970s. If I recall correctly, for example, labor productivity growth in the euro area was around 7% in 1970 and is today only 1%. And that impinges, of course, on the growth potential of an economy and thereby also on the return on capital and on the level of yields in equilibrium. Finally, the demographic transition is another important aspect here. The key driver is savings in anticipation of longer retirement periods, right? So longevity is going up, and this is a global phenomenon. So this also concerns large emerging market economies where predictions are that working age population growth is going to stall by the middle of this century, and at the same time life expectancy is going up, all this incentivizing accumulating savings in anticipation of longer retirement periods, preferably as you grow old, savings in safe assets. And again, this is another important force contributing to a decline in the yields on safe assets. So these factors are interrelated, and they point to very economic challenges for policymakers in this century, actually.
Klaus, Falk and Noemi, thank you very much for coming to the podcast, and I hope you enjoy this time.
Thank you very much, Sergio. I love you.
Okay. Thank you very much.